Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Tell you what, we always have a great time at Wisconsin Public Radio. And in Vilas Hall today, you know, there was a flood in the building a couple of days ago because of the very cold weather. And then that got the pipes kind of cold, and then it got warm really quickly, and that caused the pipes to burst. And so we've been doing a lot of work in the building. Several floors were of our building. We have a seven-story building, and several floors were very heavily damaged. And fortunately, kind of for us at least, our floor was not damaged. And then today there was a little fire got started on one of the floors, and we had to sort of get out of the building. Everybody had to leave. So to make a long story short, we weren't sure that we were able to be on the air with a live show. We had recorded shows and we were all ready to go with that. But now I am happy to report that we have a live show because we got the clearance from the fire department folks, who do an outstanding job. And they said, Larry, go back in there and get your show on the air. So here I am. And I'm really happy to be able to do it because we're going to be talking with a couple of authors. And the first author we're going to be talking about today has a book about the science of recovery from exercise, from, if you've sprained, have some sort of ailment as a result of perhaps exercise. There are all kinds of things that we think about doing, and Christy Ashwanden has written a book about, well, it's called Good to Go. And if I sound a little hesitant, it's only because we just had to come up seven flights of stairs, even though I took the elevator. I am just sitting down seconds ago. The book is called Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. So how do you recover? Do you ice? You try to ice? That may or may not be a good thing. And as a matter of fact, I learned a whole bunch in this very entertaining book that Christy's written sort of questions some of the ideas that I've always held about drinking and the amount of water that you take in when you're running and all kinds of things. And I hope you'll be able to join in as we move along today. So how do you recover from exercise? What have you tried that doesn't work? You can join in the conversation. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Christy Ashwanden, with us by phone. Christy, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we have all this excitement today, a lot of exercise running up and downstairs. I really enjoyed your book. And you know what? I'm not going to see my copy of your book probably for weeks because I already have several several people lined up who say, can I borrow that book and can I read it? It's really entertaining and very interesting. What got you interested in writing about the science of sports recovery?
Oh, that's such a great question. I guess I should just preface this, that I am a science journalist by training and by vocation. My day job is working at 538, a data journalism website, news site. But in my former life, earlier, I was a competitive athlete. I was started off as a runner. I ran for University of Colorado. Then I became a cyclist, and I also did cross-country skiing. And so after college, I traveled the world competing as a cross-country skier. And one thing that happened was that looking back on my career, I realized that recovery was something that I never really seemed to get right. It was something that, in retrospect, I can see was sort of the thing that limited me the most. And I just wish that I would have known then what I know now. And I'll just tell you that, you know, I've often heard this advice given to writers, which is write the book you want to read. Well, Good to Go is the book that I wish I had read back when I was a competitive athlete.
I bet. I actually have a couple of personal trainers who are quite interested in reading your book. And I said, good for you, because there's going to be a lot of information you can pass on to your clients as they go along. Well, there's so much research out there, and you do a nice job in the beginning of the book talking about finding credible research, and there's a lot of incredibly not credible research out there when it comes to recovery, when it comes to sports drinks, or when it comes to bars and energy bars and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this, you know, it's almost like there's science and then there's marketing. And there's a lot of marketing that's sort of masquerading as science. And I think that's really where the problem comes in.
Yeah, there's an awful lot about that. And it seems so complicated. How did it get so complicated?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, back when I was an elite athlete, recovery was really, you know, I say in the book that back then recovery was a noun. It was something you sort of waited for, and you waited for it to happen. You would, you know, in its simplest form, recovery is just rest. It's rejuvenation. It's relaxation. And, you know, back when I was a competitive athlete, we would put our feet up and put our nose in a book, or we would, you know, take rest days, and we would be sure that we weren't out late, you know, drinking with our friends and things like that. That's what recovery was. But in the meantime, it has become almost this industry where now there's sort of this endless array of products that are marketed to athletes with the promise that we're going to enhance your recovery, we'll make it quicker, we'll get you through and get you that optimal recovery much faster than you would have otherwise. And so it's really been turned in, you know, from something that you're just sort of waiting for and not doing into a product that you can purchase.
And, you know, and as you talk about it in your book, athletes, elite athletes, and those who want to be elite athletes are pretty quick to try out the latest just to get that little extra edge.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one thing that I really discovered while researching the book is that these companies really exploit this FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out. And, you know, they foster this sense that there's some secret out there that we can give you, and you know, you don't want to be without it. And if you're a competitive athlete, and even if you're not, you know, that competitive, I think most people who are exercising, you know, are doing it with some sort of sense of purpose, and whether they're just trying to get more fit or more healthy, or they're trying, you know, they're an athlete who's trying to get faster or stronger, there's this sense of you want to get the most that you can out of it. And these companies really, you know, they foster this idea that they have something that's magical and no one wants to be left out.
Well, I tell you, let's talk about sports drinks. You tell a very entertaining story about how Gatorade got going. But what are sports drinks supposed to do, and how much benefit are they?
Yeah, so the idea behind them and the way that they're sort of marketed is that, you know, your body is in this delicate balance, and when you're exercising, you have these extraordinary needs, and you're sweating, and you're losing both fluids and salt through your sweat, and this is really crucial, and you're going to, you know, collapse, and your performance will crater if you're not replacing all of this. And this is actually, I want to say, this is absolutely true to an extent. But what's happened is they've really sort of made it into something far more complicated than it needs to be. And if you sit back for a moment and think about it, the thing that is extraordinary is not the idea that our bodies are moving or exercising. You know, that's what our bodies evolved to do. Our ancestors were, you know, doing physical activity. The thing that's extraordinary these days is our sedentary lifestyles. And that, you know, I would argue that our sedentary lifestyles are the things that give us, you know, extraordinary nutritional needs and all of that. But our bodies are very well adapted to being able to cope with changing environmental conditions. And so we're very capable of losing some fluids through sweat while exercising and not collapsing and dying. And what's ended up happening is because these companies have convinced us that, you know, you can't just drink when you're thirsty. You have to, by the time you're feeling thirsty, it's too late. You have to drink early and often. They've actually helped foster this problem that's really serious, we now have people who are collapsing and dying from drinking too much. It's called water intoxication or hyponatremia, and it's a really serious condition. And, you know, I'll say it's still, thankfully, quite rare. But it's something that, you know, is completely avoidable if people would simply drink to thirst.
And you give some examples in the book of actually people passing out while running a marathon or something, and then the first thing that happens is they were given more water to drink, and in fact, they were already overhydrated.
Yeah, it's quite tragic. And, you know, we've really, one thing that I discovered while researching the book, you know, we've been taught that dehydration is this really dangerous thing. And look, I want to be very clear here. I am not saying don't drink. It's important to replace fluids while you're exercising, absolutely, to an extent. But we're also, this idea that you need to replace every single drop that you sweat out is just not supported by the science. Our bodies are capable of losing fluids. You have this very sophisticated feedback mechanism that ensures it's sort of very protective of your blood and your organs to make sure that, you know, you're staying healthy, and particularly while you're exercising, that you can perform. And so while I was researching the book, I thought, you know, we've been told that dehydration is so dangerous, and I looked far and wide for an example of someone who had died of dehydration during an athletic event, and I wasn't able to find any confirmed instance of this. But what I did find is that dehydration had sort of become this catch-all phrase. And so whenever someone, you know, had trouble exercising in the heat, they were always said to be, you know, having dehydration, and it was dehydration. And that just may in fact be the case in some instances. But it is not, you know, the life-threatening thing that this other, you know, over-drinking has become. And look, people do die of dehydration, but they do it when they're, you know, hiking in the desert and they run out of water. They don't do it on a football field where there's, you know, water nearby.
Weird. Oh, man. We're talking today with Christy Ashwandan about her book, Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. You can join in with your own questions or comments or maybe your experiences to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Poltratz, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network, talking today with Christy Ashwandan, who is author of Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. She has a great background. She's an elite athlete. She is now the lead science writer at 538. Former health columnist for the Washington Post, a champion runner, cyclist, and cross-country skier. And she did a lot of research and tried a lot of things, but also then looked at the science and the good research, and some of the bad, actually, behind all of the different things that are done to us or that you do to yourself when you're trying to recover. So join in with your own questions, comments, or experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We talked about sports drinks, but what about power bars and all the nutrition bars that came after? And you do tell a nice story about how these got started, but what can they do for recovery, if anything?
Well, I think the benefit of energy bars and recovery bars is that they're convenient. You know, it's something that if you are, I'll just lay out a scenario. Let's say you are an office worker, you go to the gym on your lunch hour, or you go for a run on your lunch hour, you have to get back to work, you have a meeting, you only have so much time to get washed up and whatever. It's a very convenient and easy form of nutrients. You can sort of refuel doing that. But in terms of, like, are they better than regular food, the answer is probably not. And, you know, they really did start off as something that was to be convenient for athletes and to make sure that they're getting the nutrients that they needed. But what I found in my research is that we really don't need anything that's, like, specially engineered, that regular food is okay. There used to be an idea that there was something called the sort of the magical window, the post-recovery, the post-exercise recovery window. And this idea was that you really needed to eat something within 20 or 30, sometimes it was said to be 40 minutes, and that your body was like had these extraordinary needs at that point. And if you replenished your fuel at that point, it was extra eager and able to take that stuff up and sort of replenish itself. But what's ended up happening is subsequent studies, you know, this was initially supported by research, but they were small initial studies, and science is an iterative process. And so it's, you know, we sometimes think of science as being something that sort of provides the answer. But what I learned while researching this book is that science is really a process. It's not an answer. It's a process. I like to think of it. A source once told me that science is a process of uncertainty reduction. And I think that's a really good way of putting it. And so with this post-exercise window, what ended up happening is there were some initial studies that made it look like, yeah, if you refuel right after exercise, you know, your glycogen stores are replenished right away and everything's really great. And that's true. But what ended up happening is when they started looking at, okay, so let's compare now if you refuel, you know, 30 minutes after exercise versus 2 hours later, and it turned out that, you know, this wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And so it is extremely important that you refuel, like, quite soon after if you are about to perform again. If you're in a situation where, you know, you're doing a race, let's say you're at a track meet, you're doing a race and then you have to go do another race a few hours later. That's a situation when you do want to hit this recovery window. But if you're not exercising again until the next day or 12 hours later or something like that, it's really not so crucial. I had one researcher I talked to said, you know, it's not really a recovery window. It's more like a recovery barn door. You really have much more time. And yeah, this goes back to this idea that we've been taught that our bodies are these really delicate machines and everything's in balance. And, you know, if you do something just a tiny bit wrong, everything's off balance and nothing will go right. And it's really sort of the opposite of how our bodies work. Like, they're pretty good at making do with the situations we throw at them. And as long as you have a good meal, you have it in a somewhat timely fashion, it can be hours later, you're going to be okay, and your body's going to replenish itself, and you'll be fine.
So, and sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to be the greatest meal in the world. I loved your story about that you told about the Olympic runner.
Yes, Usain Bolt.
Usain Bolt.
Nope.
Tell that story.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, this kind of started at the Beijing Olympics, and at that time, his coach on the team said, you know, they have food at the Olympic Village, and they had all different varieties of things that athletes could eat, but they also had some local foods, and they could go out into town and eat something. But the coach said, you know, I really advise you not to eat the local food, not because there's anything wrong with it, but, you know, now is not the time to, like, eat strange foods that you're not familiar with and you're not sure how you will handle them. And, you know, there might be some things that you don't prefer to eat, some different types of meat that we don't eat in America, I'll just say. So anyway, so Usain Bolt was a little bit freaked out by this, and he decided, you know, I'm not going to eat that stuff. I'm going to go to the Olympic Village. And so he subsisted during that time almost entirely chicken McNuggets from the McDonald's that was set up in the Olympic Village. The guy won multiple gold medals. And so, you know, you could say that, oh, you know, chicken McNuggets are gold medal fuel, or you can say, you know, Usain Bolt is the fastest sprinter alive, and, like, it probably doesn't, you know, whether he wins or loses is probably not contingent on what he ate for lunch.
I love that story. Steven Madison has a comment here for us. Let's go there. Steve, hi.
Sure.
Hi. I'm just wondering if the author has studied Jack LaLanne at all. Probably the healthiest known human being that's ever lived. You know, and he seemed to be able to do 23 push-ups or 1,000 push-ups, over 1,000 push-ups in 23 minutes, or swim San Francisco Bay, and he seemed to hop out of bed and do it the next day and do something extraordinary again. So,
well, and he was quite a good marketer, too, if I'm not mistaken. Christy, did you find Jack LaLanne in your studies?
Sure. So his name certainly came up. You know, there was a lot of the stuff that is known and has been studied about sports nutrition comes out of bodybuilding, and Jack LaLanne was kind of part of that movement, I would say. So for instance, the idea that protein is important for athletes, that really came out of the bodybuilders, and they were saying, look, you know, if you're training hard, and particularly to build muscle, protein is important, which it turns out is correct. And so he was sort of part of that. No, I didn't specifically. So in the book, he's not mentioned specifically, I don't think, and he didn't have any recovery tips that I mentioned. But he's definitely a leader, I would say, or sort of a front runner in this whole fitness movement. And the idea, too, that you could have this amazing longevity as an athlete and as an active person.
Steve, thank you. Nancy in Milwaukee, let's go to you. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning to both of you. I'm calling because I'd like your guest to talk about the benefits of drinking whey protein powder. I use this a lot, and I'm not really using it for replenishing after exercise. I'm really using it to simply not have to cook anything and still getting protein.
So, okay.
Is this an advisable thing to do?
All right.
Yeah. Well, I feel like you almost answered your own question. So there's no additional benefit that I can find to eating whey protein or any of the protein powders. But it's simply, you know, a source of protein. So if you don't have another preferred source or you don't like, you know, personally, I raise chickens, and so I eat a lot of eggs. I love eggs. They're highly nutritious. They're easy to eat in a variety of ways. But, you know, if you're someone who has trouble, you know, getting the protein that you want or you don't like, you know, particular things, it's one way to do it. There's no additional benefit, though. And it's kind of interesting when you look at, like, where these products came from. Some of it was just, like, you know, they had this extra stuff hanging around after they're making other products from dairy. And it's like, oh, we can market this as a protein thing. You know, it was almost like they've created this great industry of powders out of this sort of byproduct of manufacturing.
But it's still protein.
It's still protein. The one thing that I would caution, so I do have an anecdote in the book. So there's a whole chapter on nutritional supplements.
Yes.
And the takeaway is that these things are not very regulated, and so it can be very difficult to know what you're getting. And it's not just a matter of saying, okay, we just need to find a reputable company. A lot of these things are all sort of sourced from the same places, and even companies that are trying to do good things may end up, and you can end up with things that are somehow tainted because they've been manufactured in a facility that made something else. And the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, which is a group that does the drug testing for Olympic athletes, they actually have a huge educational program going right now to try and educate athletes about these things. And in fact, their advice is basically they cannot say sort of straight out, do not take these things, because a lot of sports, it turns out, are sponsored by nutritional supplement companies. So there's a little bit of a dance that goes on. But there are so many athletes now who have tested positive on drug tests because they've taken a supplement that was somehow tainted, usually with some sort of steroid or some other banned substance. And in the book I talk about there were some athletes who actually traced a positive drug test back to protein powders. Now, that doesn't mean that most or all protein powders have this, but there was also a Consumer Reports project a few years ago that was looking at this, and they actually found that there were dangerous levels of, I believe it was some heavy metals and things, and in particular protein supplements. So I think it's a little bit buyer beware, and so if you can get it from food, that's better. But you know,
there is a way. There is a testing, isn't there? You talked about a testing organization that actually tests for these for certain products. You talked about a woman who takes these supplements, but she's not worried about it because the company itself has agreed to have its products tested?
Right. I mean, the problem is so terrible that the companies themselves are now participating in these programs to try and say, no, we're legitimate. And that particular company started participating in this because one of the athletes they sponsored tested positive from one of their products and missed an Olympics because of it. And, of course, this is all litigated, and the company, I'll just say, denies that it was their product. But the anti-doping agencies did determine, you know, make the determination that that was the source. But the athletes still received a ban. It was a lesser ban than it would have been. So I think that the fact that they're feeling the need to have these testing programs tells you how deep the problem goes.
Yeah. Is there anything that you can look at on a label that would be more, I don't know, make you less worried about it?
No, not really.
I was trying to think of a testing agency or something. Okay, I couldn't. There was a testing agency in your book, and I just can't remember the name of it now.
But yeah, there are multiple agencies, but they, you know, I don't want to disparage any of them. I don't think that they're not doing good work, but it's just the problem goes so deep. And, you know, I spoke with some lawyers who've represented people who, you know, athletes who have tested positive like this, and they said, look, there's no guarantees, and none of these companies are telling athletes, like, if you test positive after taking our product, we'll defend you, and that's sort of telling, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for calling. I want to give Steve and Madison a chance to join in. Steve, hello to you.
Hello, Larry, and guest. Nice to speak with you.
Yeah, what's on your mind today?
Well, we had someone call and mention Jack LaLanne. I want to step back into gears as well. Will Chamberlain was one of the original elite kind of super athletes. He was, in addition to being one of the dominant basketball player of his time, at 7 foot and 280, he was a sprinter and hurdler and shot putter in college at Kansas. And I remember distinctly in his first book where he spoke of his what he did at halftime to replenish. He drank, this is pre-Gatorade era, he drank a mix of a gallon of grape juice and 7-Up, and he would eat two or three citrus cream pies, like key lime or lemon meringue pie.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, he led the league in minutes played for a number of years. I don't know offhand how many, but, you know,
yeah,
had a very long, powerful career. So.
Yeah, well, Christy, a comment?
Yeah, no, it's interesting, and I think it goes back to this idea. I mean, look, I think we can probably agree a gallon of fluids to take in before an event. I mean, I know how my stomach and, you know, you're sort of putting all this blood now to your digestive system that has to deal with this. It might not be optimal, and yet here he performed really well, and he's eating these foods that we may or may not think are healthy or good. And I think it goes back to this idea that, you know, our bodies are pretty good at coping with the conditions that we throw at them. And so, you know, this idea that if we just eat the exact perfect nutrient, you know, that that's going to be performance enhancing, that's probably true, but it's probably true to such a minuscule amount that, like, the time and effort and stress and energy going toward, you know, finding that thing may be just counterproductive.
Steve, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. One of the, another, well, every chapter, frankly, I found interesting. You even talk about getting Tom Brady's pajamas.
yeah.
And that's certainly timely right at the moment. But I want to, before that, talk about cold and icing for recovery. There were some things there that I thought, wow. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So we have this idea, you know, this is something that was also popular back in my day, was ice baths. You know, we would go, especially after a hot bike race, we would go sit in a hot or in a cold tub with ice. Very painful, I might say.
Yeah.
In there and you know, the idea is that you're cooling your muscles and that the whole sort of sell on this was that you're reducing inflammation. But what's really interesting is it turns out that inflammation is sort of an important process. If you are training to get faster and stronger and fitter, inflammation is part of the process by which those adaptations occur. So, you know, these inflammatory things come in and they are responsible to some extent in making your muscles stronger, repairing damage that is done during exercise, and that repair process is sort of what helps with the strength gains and things like that. And so, you know, ice is sold as this thing that's reducing inflammation, and it's true that it does that. It's also temporary, which is kind of interesting. So you're not doing long-term, you're not having long-term effects with that. But what's interesting is, so by reducing inflammation, it turns out you may actually reduce gains, and there's some interesting research suggesting this, you know, where they do things like they have people exercise their limbs and they only ice one and not the other, and they find that they become a little less adapted than the one that did not get the cold. So if you are training hard in hopes of getting better, you probably want to skip the ice. On the other hand, ice does have one nice property, which is it's numbing. So if you get into an ice bath, it hurts like hell at first, but after a while, everything just goes numb. So if you can last long enough for that, you could numb everything up, and that might feel good. But in terms of really aiding recovery, it doesn't seem to be something that's helpful. So if you're someone like me who's never enjoyed ice baths, I hereby give you permission to quit.
One thing that you really enjoyed was the salt water, the float tanks.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny. They used to call these sensory deprivation chambers, you know, but that sort of sounds like torture, right? And so, although it's probably a better description of what it is. And so now these things have been rebranded as float tanks or float pods. And so what you do is you go into this very small pool of water that's in some sort of enclosed. There are different versions of this, but it's in some sort of enclosed space. And so the water is very, very salty. It's also very shallow. I mean, we're really just talking about a few inches here, but it's so salty that your body becomes very buoyant, and you can just sort of float effortlessly and weightlessly. It feels really good and very relaxing. And then, you know, it's dark. There's no sound. The water temperature is actually, this is really interesting, the water is body temperature, so it feels neither warm nor cold. And so what it really does is sort of allows you to relax and sort of let go of all the outside things, to really just be fully present in your body. And I was really hesitant. You know, the only reason I even tried this was for the book, and I thought, you know, I hate that I have to do this, but I'm going to write about this. I need to try it. And I fell in love with it. I just found it to be extremely relaxing. It was probably the thing that I liked best of all the things that I tried while reporting the book.
That was your description of that was really great. I like, I've got to try that sometime. It really sounded wonderful to me. Well, Super Bowl just over. We cannot get you away without talking about Tom Brady's pajamas.
Yeah. So I tried them out. So Tom Brady, you know, he is something like 41 years old now, and he's very well known for both his great football abilities, but also just his longevity in his career. And, you know, the guy just won another Super Bowl at his age. And so it was funny, as a journalist, on Monday morning, my inbox is filling up with all of these press releases from various companies that were attributing that Super Bowl win to Tom Brady's, you know, endorsement of their product or use of their product, or somehow it's amazing how people can somehow refer to him even in things that, you know, he's not endorsing. Anyway, but Tom Brady is very well known for going to bed early. He really prioritizes sleep. And as I describe in the book, sleep is the magical formula for recovery. If there's one thing that truly is magic and is just really wonderful for recovery, it's sleep. And so Tom Brady has that right. But he also has now this brand of recovery pajamas, and they're supposed to have special infrared powers. They have some sort of lining inside that reflects body heat back as infrared radiation. And you may be wondering, what is infrared radiation? It's a kind of heat. So these pajamas were supposed to have these magical powers to enhance recovery. And I think that they probably do. If they're comfortable and you sleep well in them, then yes, you are having magical recovery. It's probably not the pajamas, though. And I did try them out and didn't notice any difference.
So. You bought a pair, and they're what, $180 or something? Something like that?
Yeah, they're almost $200 for the complete set. So they do not come cheaply.
Mary in Pewaukee has a question, I believe. Hi, Mary.
Hi, yes, I do. Well, I did want to make one comment before I get to the point that I called about, and that is that I've heard that a variety of exercise is just really one of the best things to do, which my husband and I try to do. Secondly, is that my daughter's boyfriend does hot yoga. I wondered if you could just give us a little information there. And what I'm getting from the show is save your money. Don't spend a lot of money except to buy your book, I guess.
You're going to enjoy the book, Mary. You're going to really enjoy the book. But what about, is hot yoga a dumb idea?
I don't think so. Yoga was something that I looked into a little bit, just in terms of, like, there are different ways to do yoga or different approaches, you know, and if you're doing it, so you can do sort of a relaxation type yoga for recovery, and that can be good. In terms of yoga as an exercise, because it can be a quite rigorous exercise as well, I didn't look into that as much. And I know with the hot yoga, a lot of people like that sort of more as a workout, whereas my book focuses much more on the recovery aspect of that. But I would just say that really the takeaway here is that at its most fundamental level, recovery is really relaxation. And so anything that helps you feel relaxed, that helps you unwind, that helps you just relax, I mean, it's really R&R, right? Rest and rejuvenation. And so anything that does that is good.
So, Mary, I guess it's okay. And by the way, what is hot yoga? It's what?
Is kept to a very warm temperature. And they just do their workout that way, which, you know, I love yoga, but as far as I was concerned, I think a normal temperature or lower temperature is usually better for most people's bodies, and especially to work out, to be able to work up to a certain heat to lose more calories is from what I kind of heard, if she has any input on that.
Christy?
Yeah, that wasn't something that I really researched for the book, so I don't feel qualified to really make a judgment on that. I'll just say that I have friends who love it. I've tried it. It is not for me. I do not like feeling overly hot. I love things like saunas and hot tubs, but I don't like exercising in the heat. So it's not for me, but I know people do enjoy it.
Thank you very much, Mary. Martha emailed, she's around 60, enjoys gym exercises, lifting weights. She has sore muscles post-workout. Sometimes it lasts 3 or 4 days. Is timing important? Should there be an interval between workouts, varying activities and muscle groups in order to avoid some of the sore muscles? And might age have something to do with it? And what about salt intake? She's got all kinds of questions.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me address the timing and all of that and the age component, because those are great questions. And so, yes, it turns out that your recovery needs do increase with age. So as you get older, it takes a little bit longer to recover from exercise. So, you know, it may be that a workout that when you're in your 20s, you know, you could be recovered from in a day. As you get to be in your 30s, 40s, 50s and beyond, it will take longer. And I think there, the key is to really read your body and notice, you know, if you're feeling fatigue, you know, it's probably a sign that you need a little more rest. And, you know, training programs are often periodized. This is getting to be maybe a little bit into more of the complexity than we want to get into. But there are ways to sort of devise a training plan so that you can give certain body parts rest while still exercising others. So it may be that, you know, you run one day and you swim another day, and so you're sort of relying on different muscle groups so that you can rest the other ones. And so that's a really good strategy, as she mentioned. But I would just say that there are no hard and fast rules about how much recovery one needs for something. And a lot of it is just learning how to read your body and trial and error, finding out what works for you. I think it's important to know, like, you can trust your body. It's okay to do that. You don't need the scientists standing over and telling you what to do.
And one more question. JT emailed to ask about chocolate milk for recovery, and you do talk about that in your book. He says it flows like water after the Birky, which is the, you probably know about the mm-hmm. Birkebeiner.
I've done the Birkebeiner, yeah.
Yeah, and it's sort of a sweet treat reward. Does it do much for your body?
Yeah, so chocolate milk is interesting. It's a good recovery drink. It has all the nutrients that you need. It's sort of, I had one nutritionist I talked to said if you were going to engineer a recovery drink from scratch, that would be, you know, a good thing to do. Is it magical? No. I mean, it's sort of like we all want the thing that's like the perfect fuel. And I would just say that chocolate milk's a great thing to have after a workout. But it's not necessarily better than, you know, maybe you prefer a banana and some yogurt and a glass of water. You know, the nice thing about chocolate milk is that it's convenient. It's something that is sort of more readily available. And I think a lot of people are really turning now to things that are more like real foods rather than things that are a little bit more engineered and more processed.
And it's not going to cost you an arm and a leg.
That's right. And, you know, there are multiple studies showing that it's a good recovery drink. So, yeah, I would say go for it.
Christy, you've written a wonderful book here. I've really enjoyed reading it, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I hope you sell a million. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been such a pleasure.
Christy Ashwanden is the author, and the book is titled, and here's her last name is Aschwanden. So that's going to be a hard one to remember, perhaps. But if you type in Good to Go, or if you just go, that's the title of the book, Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Great book, and I can certainly highly recommend, and very, and she's a great writer and very entertaining writer who is also able to write about science in a very entertaining way. And, you know, I'm a professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication along with everything else, and so I really appreciate good writing, and she is a good writer. You know, another good writer is Jerry Apps, professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's written a number of books. He's got a couple of books out that we can talk about and another one on the way. I had a chance to read his latest book called Simple Things, Lessons from the Family Farm. And we'll talk with Jerry next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.